This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Violet Microphones, on the web at violetusa.com, and by Axia Audio. The networked studio has arrived, on the web at axiaaudio.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt. Yo, T-Ray is in the house.
Hey, welcome to the network. You are watching the sausage being made.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's him?
All your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
Hey, Tom Ray and Chris Tobin are here, plus our special guest, that broadcasting soothsayer, it's Skip Peasy.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hi, it's time for This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, and thank you very much for joining us. This is the show where we talk about radio technology, including audio, digital audio, analog audio, the way we used to do things, the way we do things now, and the way we might do engineering and radio in the future. So we talk about audio. We also talk about RF technology. In other words, ways to deliver audio to the masses, to the listeners, or in the case of some radio stations like the one I own, a few here and there throughout the countryside. So along with us on the show, let me introduce our co-host. We have with us the inimitable Tom Ray from Hudson Valley, New York. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Kirk. Good evening, and thanks for having me again. I somehow never get thrown off. I'm Vice President of Engineering for Buckley Broadcasting, WOR Radio in New York City. And yes, I'm up here in the Hudson Valley in New York, about 50 miles north of the city, just sitting here staring at a camera. It's great.
You know, one of these shows, Tom, we are going to just have you pick up your webcam and show it around your radio shack so we can see all the goodies that you have. Tom is quite the ham radio operator, aren't you?
And quite the ham. So,
yeah. Okay. Also with us from Manhattan, the middle part. What is that? What do you call that part of Manhattan?
Midtown.
Or Mr. Tobin? Midtown. Yes, Midtown Manhattan. It's Chris Tobin, the guy who wears a tuxedo to work at CBS Radio. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. Hello, Tom and Skip. I'm the broadcast technologist at CBS Radio here in New York City at the 6 radio stations we own and operate, 3 AMs and 3 FMs. You were saying something, Kirk?
And a couple weeks ago, I got a very nice tour of that place. Thanks, Chris. I appreciate that.
It's a rather impressive
looking facility, especially that sports radio station.
WFAN, yes. It's actually funny because it's a radio station in physical form, but we actually produce 6 different sports networks from the radio station and approximately 6 hours of video a day. And now we've started up a new webcam service for the morning show. So we're now up to 10 hours a day of some type of video from the radio station and many other things.
For sports fans or webcam fans, where would they go on the internet to see some of that activity, or what channels would they look at?
Okay, the first thing is WFAN.com, and then just click on the various radio buttons for the video. And then if you're a fan of Mike Francesa, who's also our afternoon radio host, he can be viewed on the YES Network on cable. So it's the Madison Square Garden. No, it's YES Network is the Yankees. So you'll find it on cable across the country and direct television.
Cool. Chris Tarr is not with us this week. He is studying up on FM transmission technology for our Foundation series, which returns next week. We'll talk about the basics of FM modulation, amplification, transmission, propagation, and reception, all that stuff. We did an AM series last week on show number 24, so number 26 will be all the fundamentals of FM, including how does the magic of FM stereo work. But now it's time to introduce our guest. And he's been here before. We're very glad to have him back. It's Mr. Skip Peasy. Hi, Skip.
Hi, guys. Glad to be back. How y'all doing?
Good. Where are you talking to us from?
I am in Fairfax, Virginia. Finally getting out from under the snow here, although I hear Denver's got some today. It's amazing winter we've been having here. But any event, I am a consultant to the broadcast industry. And as of recently, the new technology editor at Radio Inc. magazine. We're looking forward to our first edition coming out at NAB, the April 5th edition. We'll have a new whole new section called Tech Inc. It's going to actually start on the back cover upside down. So it's kind of fun. writing an upside down magazine. I feel like I'm in Australia or something. But
that,
anyway,
does that mean interesting. Does that mean that you can't sell the back cover now because the cover of the back cover is the cover?
Well, you're way ahead of us there. That's and actually no, we've come up with a hybrid to accommodate that actually. So yeah, there'll be an ad on the back cover as well. So, but it should be fun, and we're looking forward to taking that to NAB and showing it to folks and getting a whole new technology publication for the industry going.
Skip, you've been a technology editor for some time. I think that's about the time that you and I met is when you were the technology or the editor for Radio Engineering Magazine. Yeah?
Right. Yeah, it's going way back. I started, I started at Radio World just as when I was at NPR. Just as a contributor, a columnist. And then we went to, I went on staff at Broadcast Engineering Magazine out in Kansas City. And then we split, that was when it was both a TV and radio magazine combined. We split it into two parts, and I took over the radio magazine, which was called BE Radio originally, and now it's just called Radio Magazine. And then handed the reins of that over to our old buddy Chris Shearer, who is still there. And I went off to Microsoft for a while, over to the dark side there, and then finally moved back to East with them and was working back with Radio World again as a contributing editor until the end of last year, and now moved over to Radio Inc. So, yeah, full circle. I don't think there's any other magazines in the industry that I can can find yet, so we'll see.
Well, maybe you'll do some contributions for Radio Guide sometime.
There's a couple other guys out there.
Yeah, Barry Michigan and his crew do okay with that magazine. We're actually glad to have Barry Michigan as a supporter of this podcast. He's he did a lot of some work with me early on, mostly just encouraging me to get going with this thing. And so we give him a plug every now and then for his website at thebdr.net, a broadcaster's desktop resource. So, Skip, we've got a number of subjects to talk about, but I'd like to ask you a bit more about what you did at Microsoft. It seemed to me that you and I lost touch for a couple of years when you were there, and I didn't hear much about it, but had something to do with media. Would you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, I first went out there to work on their audio production facility. They were building a big multimedia production facility for all kinds of products there, as well as services on the MSN network. And that was a lot of fun, but it didn't last too long. They split that apart into separate components. They were trying to run it like a real Hollywood-type digital back lot, they used to call it. And have it be this real professionally run studio facility that anybody that wanted to use it could use. But Microsoft's a little more of a fiefdom than that. They like to work in little separate pods, like little startups. So rather than going to a single kind of corporate entity, they preferred having the different systems split up. But I had a fun job there for a while working on a Pro Tools-based system. It was the biggest Pro Tools facility in the world at that time, 12 different rooms. And in those days, it was Pro Tools only ran on the Mac, so it was kind of fun taking a job at Microsoft working on Macs. but then when I got there, I realized they make a lot of – they're the biggest maker of Mac software, application software in the world. So that's a big part of their business. So it's both a Mac and a PC world. People don't often realize that out there in Redmond. So I moved over into a number of other jobs. They like you to keep moving around there, and it's a great thing. I ended up working in broadcast relations for the company as they got more and more into that with interactive television. Started working with them on their standards committees for that in the broadcast world, and acting as a guide to get them into the broadcasting environment, because it's a pretty different world than software. And then as they got into that, they also found themselves getting more into more and more regulated business. And that's when they sent me back to D.C. to work in that space here at Government Affairs, working in the regulatory space. So it was a nice run there for a number of different areas, from actual hands-on audio to highbrow, highfalutin standards and regulatory, legislative, working with lawyers, and you know all sorts of all pretty much all directions you could imagine in the media space there, which the company has done. It started off just as a PC, you know, software company, and got into the home entertainment business, the mobile phone business, and a lot of areas that are much more regulated than IT is, and that was why we ended up needing a lot more folks in DC. And they're still moving on, doing well.
That has got to be so different than stripping wire and designing studios and making yeah. sure people who produce audio programs have the tools that they need, which you know was some of your original work.
Yeah, that was a big adjustment the first year or so I was there. That I had to get used to the fact that just because you worked on something for several weeks didn't mean that it was actually going to come to fruition. And, didn't you get the email? That was canceled yesterday. And then I realized also, don't delete the files because next week it might be back on. So it was like moving from a battleship to a pinball machine, you know, in terms of the trajectory du jour. And that's just the way the software business is and can be. And you have to be that kind of you have to have that kind of agility. And interestingly, now broadcasting has kind of got to do the same thing. As we move more and more into that digital domain, the fungibility, the variability, the day-to-day changes, that the pace of progress in the digital world that radio now finds itself in really changed is changing the way things have been in the past, and as part of this whole subject matter, I guess we'll be talking about the rest of the show here. What radio needs to do to move forward and stay abreast of all that very fast-paced change, which is not something that they're that used to in the traditional environment of broadcasting.
Well, we've got just 45 minutes, in fact, to cover several things. And I want to catch up real quickly on something that you talked about the last time that you were on with a Skip, and that's Radio DNS. You have an update for us about the organizational activities that have been going on and things are becoming more official. Is that right?
Yeah, they've formed an actual SDO now, a Standards Development Organization, and they've got their kind of rules getting put into place. They're actually having an election in I guess it's next week, where they will elect their chairman and secretary and a board of a nine-person steering board. And there's some, although this is basically a European-based operation, they have a number of U.S. folks that are involved already and are running for positions on that steering board. So it looks like it'll be a sort of an international thing, at least a European, North American thing at first, and hopefully broader than that as we move forward. And they're looking to, right now, working on possibilities of having a pretty nice display at the NAB. We'll see if that actually comes to fruition. They're working on it right now and looking into the opportunities there to reach out across the water here and really get folks interested and as excited as I am about what the prospects are for something like what they envision in terms of putting radio and the internet together in a new kind of way.
Well, you talked about this on the last time you were here, so if people want to go back and find that episode called Radio DNS, they can find out that. But when there's some technology things to talk about, perhaps after NAB sometime, Skip, maybe you could come and update on that. One of the subjects that Skip wanted to talk about was the slightly improving radio ad market. Some radio stations, some groups are reporting a little bit better prospects for this year as ads slumped for most of last year. Let's check in with Tom and Chris. Tom, I know, you know, we're all engineers, but my goodness, sometimes in the hallways and in the conference rooms, we hear what's going on and our budgets are certainly affected by how sales are going. Tom, how, without divulging how things are going at Buckley Broadcasting, do you have a sense of ad sales if they're going to be looking better sometime this year?
We've seen a little bit of up, and we've seen it go back down again, so we're holding pretty much flat right now, as far as I understand. So we haven't seen a heck of a lot of improvement yet, but We can only hope that that's, I mean, it can't get much worse than it's been. So, and I think that's true for all markets.
Chris, how about you? I got to visit you a couple weeks ago in New York. It didn't seem to be all gloom and doom, was it?
No. I will say that sales are probably off from where they would like them to be. But we've been actually very creative in our non-traditional revenue approach, and we're doing a lot more with, let's say, how would you call it, an internet radio hybrid approach. Last night, if you were lucky enough to hear about it, we did a record or CD release with Justin Bieber, the Canadian phenom that's running through the pop charts right now, and at a local business. And we had that up on Ustream TV. We had it up on the CBS internet networks, all our various networks we have. And we called it Bieber TV. And we also did a joint video with radio with Tribune Broadcasting. So if you are fortunate enough to be in, I think it's LA with KTLA, I think that's a Tribune station, and Chicago WGN, you would have saw some of that on there. I think they had it on their HD channels. So it was good. So record label, working with the radio station, and then some local businesses. I would say we're tapping a different market. It's doing well. I'm not saying it's stellar, but we're definitely not crying, oh my goodness, we're closing the doors tomorrow. That's not the case.
Skip, you told me before the show that there's still some Chapter 11 filings. What's given you some encouragement for later on in the year?
Well, I've been looking at some of the reports, particularly the ones coming out of BIA, BIA Kelsey group that does this basically as their main business. And their research is showing, as others have said, mild upticks right now, but pretty reasonable growth potential over the next few years, and showing radio as well as other advertising media other than print getting back on their feet and going forward. So there's some reason for optimism, but as everyone I think agrees, it's not immediate, and it's not anything we're going to see that's real sudden and meteoric upturn or anything like that. But at least looks like we've turned a corner, or at least hit bottom, and are bouncing and going, in a way that makes the arrows turn in the right direction. Also, things are getting cheaper to do, which helps in a lot of ways. So that all bodes well for us that deal on the technology side of the business to have some continuing job security there and application and value.
The NAB show is coming up. It starts in a couple 3 weeks or so. Skip, you say that there's going to be some new things there to look out for, maybe some new technologies. What should broadcasters be looking at implementing themselves, either as far as equipment or services or ways to continue to try to make inroads in IP broadcasting, whether it's audio or as Chris Tobin just mentioned, doing something on Ustream TV? What kind of where do you see broadcasters should be looking at NAB, those who are going?
Right. I think, well, obviously there's always tons of stuff to look at, but this year, it's as a very high level kind of guidance, I would say look at ways of integration, ways that you can make the facility more agile, make it easier to for the programmers to do things in ways that are that are kind of platform independent, or at least flexible enough to be able to mash up on air and online. I still feel that the combination of on air and online service from a single provider, that synergy is just so powerful. It's broadcasters' game to lose because anybody can get on the internet with a service, more or less, but not everybody can get a broadcast license. And the fact that a broadcaster can get into both spaces and leverage that synergy across the two media, two platforms, is just a huge potential. Now, that said, you still have to actually make it work and monetize it. So that's the challenge that's before us right now. I mean, the internet is there. The wireless nature of it for radio, and particularly, is pretty much started to get there. So it's now just a matter of leveraging those opportunities. And for broadcast engineering, it's a matter of making that possible, making it easy, and it really enabling the folks who are really trying to start thinking about ways to put those two media to their best combined and converged application. Yeah. So that's where we're heading. I think that's the thing I'd be looking at this year for any opportunities and tools for that.
Well, let's think about advice for engineers. Now, Chris Tobin has mentioned some things they've done in New York City with the CBS stations. I know that at Buckley Broadcasting, Tom stations, they're available on the web. Some of the shows at Buckley, some of the talk shows have their own web pages and websites. Sure, a lot of broadcasters do that. How do you think engineers should involve themselves in the process when they don't really drive the process? That's more for radio management and programming to drive. How can an engineer add to that conversation most effectively? And you know what we're talking about? Engineers being able to prolong or save or expand their own jobs. So this is really something that engineers need to pay attention to, being ready to provide the technologies to do what management and programming want to do. So what do you think engineers should be involving themselves with to educate about this sort of thing?
I think that you're exactly right. It's not the engineer's decisions to make, but they have to. They really do have to get aware of as much as they possibly can about the way the IP environment works, the way their facilities can be quickly reconfigured, and the working more closely than perhaps they have in the past with some of the programmers and producers, managers, because there's a lot more need for those folks to understand what is possible. And, you know, they can have a pipe dream and then it find out that it's just prohibitive to do, or it's just unworkable in that facility. So I think the good news is, you know, broadcast engineering has never been more important, or the engineering, whatever you want to call it, support, the technology support at a broadcaster's facility has never been more important because of all these new opportunities staring folks in the face. That's why that also means there's a lot more threats too, because the barriers to entry for competitors continues to get lower and lower. So broadcasters have to think about what it is that they can do that leverages their existing strengths. And there's by no means not a lot of that to go around. There's plenty of real strength in broadcasting that can be applied to as a real launching pad for these services in the new domain. And so the engineers really need to be as comfortable and conversant with all those opportunities. And I've seen plenty of them doing it, and it's just real encouraging to see how they can kind of take off with some of these new environments at the, you know, nuts and bolts level all the way up to the, you know, content creation kind of level and service design level. So I think that's where we need to be. And engineers have that fantastic opportunity to be valuable to their employers and to the broadcast community in general.
Skip, I hope that in your new job with Radio Inc. magazine, you would have an opportunity to provide columns and articles and information that engineers can use, and maybe that management and engineering can look at together to figure out what's available for them to do. You know what's so disappointing, and the touch point where things don't happen is when a programmer or a manager has an idea of something they'd like to do on the web or in some kind of interactive multimedia way, and the engineer doesn't know how to implement it. And this engineer could very well lose out, or lose out to a consultant, or the station may not do what they thought would be a good idea to do.
Yeah, yep. those lines of communication are really important to establish and open up in a richer way than they have been before, because it's not just a matter of doing the same thing you did yesterday. And there's so many fundamental, deeper questions that that programmers are going to be asking now, that the door needs to be open, the channel needs to be established for them to say, well, let's go ask the engineer if this is possible. And you may not always have the answer on hand, but you want to be able to get back to them with something really, actionable as soon as possible. And you're right, Kirk, that's exactly what we're trying to do with the new Radio Inc. magazine. Coming from a magazine that already is established as a manager's magazine, trying to make it trying to make managers a little more conversant with the technology, high-level stuff, but also have something that's useful for reading by engineers that can have that, or at least start that conversation and open up that dialogue a little bit more. Give you an example, the first the first issue will have a cover story that's just a laundry list, basically, of all the technologies that we see on the horizon or emerging or actually starting to be implemented right now that broadcasters and their engineers need to be up to speed on. And we also have a column on the new codec that MPEG is working on that's going to probably be another order of magnitude better than what we've had before in terms of bandwidth requirements. Now you say, well, why do we need that anymore? Geez, this broadband thing is happening. Bandwidth doesn't matter anymore, especially for audio.
This is exactly what I asked you at AES, because you told me about this codec. And I went over to the Fraunhofer booth to have a look at it. But before I did, I said, but Skip, after I got back, I said, Skip, okay, this thing works at 16 kilobits per second, but don't we have broadband nowadays? Is this important? I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead and tell us why.
Yeah,
it's
you're right. That's the first question you ask, and the real the answer is pretty obvious too. Is that, well, yeah, but now we're talking about wireless, mobile, and there, you can't make more spectrum. It's a finite amount. And so anything you can do to make those unicast wireless streams less requiring of bandwidth, that's a great thing. So I think we're going to really see that be the place where that is applied. It's like any codec change, it takes years for these things to get established and deployed. But it's just amazing to see. And what we're trying to do is give a little heads up on what's going on as it's happening. For broadcasters to just sort of stretch their minds or around some of these things and see what's coming. You always want to try to be a few steps ahead. And we have a piece written by some of the leaders of the Radio DNS organization talking about that thing that we were mentioning earlier, and they explain how it works in a level of detail that I think will be interesting to both hopefully managers and engineers. Trying to walk that fine line that keeps the managers from their eyes glazing over and keeps the engineers interested in feeling like they're not just reading fluff.
Yeah. Hey, Tom and Chris, I've got a place I want to go with the interview here in just a moment. But at this point, you got any questions for Skip before I move on to asking him about Arbitron and PPM and what is it and how does all that work?
Not really, but I just wanted to make a comment that Skip is right with all the new technologies. It becomes a way to you have to marry the traditional broadcast facility into the internet and into the new ways to get your signal out there. As an old radio guy like myself, I mean, I'm sure Chris has done this also. We've touched on television and worked with television in the past, but as you start getting into web video and such, you start getting into things like lighting that you haven't had to do before. You start getting into doing video, and everybody's first reaction is, well, just pop a webcam up, and let's face it, what we're on right now isn't exactly 1080p video, but you still have that theory, garbage in, garbage out. If you don't put a very good picture in, you're not going to get a very good picture out on the web. It's a challenge, but it's also interesting and a lot of fun, and it's definitely not boring right now. But But boy, let me tell you, keeping up with some of the technologies right now is, you know, just the speed with the way things change and everything comes out. Because we're starting to look at various different things, you know, with Buckley and with WOR, and it's mind blowing. It really is.
Mr. Tobin, you guys are doing some things at CBS. Is what Skip's saying ringing true with your experience in engineering there?
Oh, absolutely. Matter of fact, just last night, I'll refer to this outside broadcast we did. I set up a IP codec for the audio back to the studio for radio broadcast. I set up a computer with three webcams for the video portion of the broadcast. I set up two mixed minuses, one for the other video portion, which was the television station that was involved, and then for the webcam material that we were doing. Plus, I had three wireless microphones for the talent to use so they can move about the venue and interact with the audience so that they were pretty much non-tethered. So for a typical radio broadcast that, say, 10 years ago would have been just a, you know, we'll say an ISDN or a POTS codec or maybe a MARTI, RPU, RPT, you know, wire, 450 megahertz transmitter, has now turned into a, how would you say, multi-video production. And we did lighting, we did audio, we did everything last night. And from what I can see, I think this year will be more of that.
A lot of the subject that Skip is going to be covering in his Tech Inc. part of his magazine are things that we have talked about a little bit here on our show in past weeks, things like getting audio to the transmitter site over IP and doing remote broadcasts using IP technologies and IP technologies in the newsroom for bringing interviews in and doing higher quality interviews than you would just do on a telephone line. Also, we've talked about electronic program guide. That was a lot of the subject of the last time Skip was on. So actually, I'd like to ask Skip about something that we haven't talked about much, and that is PPM, the personal people meter from the Arbitron company. And I go to more and more stations now where I'm seeing a rack full of equipment. These are encoders. Skip, what can you tell us about what Arbitron is trying to get done here, and what are the technology's promises, and what are its pitfalls?
Yeah, that's obviously, I would think, number one issue on managers' minds when you talk about technical things going on right now and massive changes to the industry as a result. What some folks have already started to do is, as you would imagine, I guess I shouldn't call it gaming the system, but you know, just adapting their programming as they've learned how to make this thing work for their best results. And it's becoming a little bit of a pendulum effect, I hope, that at some point we'll see an extreme where there's this micromanagement of the programming so much just to get those PPM numbers up. That'll hit a wall, and folks will come back to say, okay, look, that was too much. Let's get back to sensible adaptation of what the new technology gives us, and still have our programming make sense and not be totally driven or dictated, you know, not have the tail wagging the dog. That's my hope anyway. But the point is, what the technology does, I think most folks are probably roughly familiar with it. It's injecting a signature, a low bit rate signature into the audio stream in a way that's masked by the audio. And decoders that are distributed amongst the audiences then takes that signal and basically records what station signal they heard for how much of the day. Uh-huh. And there's a little motion detector on the thing too, so it makes sure that you're not just sitting the thing next to a radio all day and having it try, you know, it's got to be on somebody. It's tough for a number of reasons. There's been some concern about the fact that different types of audio mask it differently, and in some cases maybe it's not being picked up, that there's some false negatives from that. That's yet to be really tested, I think, in any real certain way, but it is a concern. But the bigger concerns are just logistical. This obviously doesn't work by itself. You have to wear this thing on your belt. It's like a little pager. And one of the problems is if you're wearing headphones, headphone radio listening or radio audio listening in general on headphones is huge nowadays. So in order for it to capture headphone listening, you've got to have your this PPM device inserted in the headphone line between your whatever you're listening to, your MP3 player, radio, whatever, and your headphones. So they do have adapters for that, but I just wonder how cumbersome that is for people. There are folks that use these things do get some sort of a compensation scheme, because what they do is at the end of the day, they place this thing back in a charger, and the charger happens to have a phone line connected to it too, and it reports back to Arbitron's home base what it's listened to that day. So, I mean, conceptually, it's an incredible advance over the old, you know, paper and pencil diary in terms of real statistical validity or capturing of actual listening behavior. But the logistical issues with it and some of the other concerns statistically that people have, like there's just not enough of them out there. And they don't rotate them amongst different users fast enough. These are some of the arguments that have been brought up. And, you know, compared to it's much more cumbersome to manage than just sending diaries out in the mail. But, of course, technically, as I said, it has much greater statistical validity. So these are kinds of the things that they're weighing right now in terms of both the technical and logistical and statistical difficulties with this brand new thing. And it's so different than the old approach that programmers and radio stations are seeing in some cases very different book to book numbers. And, as a result, the upheaval is pretty brutal right now as it gets into more and more markets. So we'll see what ends up happening here. I mean, it's even made it to the floors of Congress, as you probably heard a few months back. And because it's very important. This is bread and butter to so many folks in this whole industry. And there's only one company, basically, although Nielsen's gotten into the business a little bit. Arbitron is for sure the monopoly on this. So there's some concern about that and how well that can be managed and how all the stakeholders are approached and how they all get a fair shake in this. So we haven't seen the end of this by any means.
I want to go back to something that you said earlier. Talking about the tech, and our show is This Week in Radio Tech, so I want to talk about the tech for just a moment of just how this – you used the word masking earlier, Skip, and I know that Tom and Chris have these encoders on their radio stations, so maybe they can tell us some of the upshot of this. But, Skip, you mentioned that this is there are signals in the audio that are injected by this Arbitron encoder that is feeding the transmitter of a radio station. And these signals are masked to the human ear. In other words, people can't detect that there's some extra audio there. But the device itself, the PPM listening device, apparently can detect that these signals, these audio tones are there. I'm thinking this works in a little bit along the same lines as psychoacoustic bitrate reduction. That is MP2, MP3, AAC. Bitrate reduction technologies, where we get rid of things that we think your ear can't hear. We don't code them. So, Tom, how is the Arbitron PPM equipment on your station? Has that affected your audio at all? And do you know that the signal is getting out even though you can't hear it?
No, Kirk, it hasn't affected the audio at all. And my understanding from how it works, the theory of psychoacoustic masking is that if you have two audio frequencies, one right next to the other, and one is lower in level, your ear doesn't have the resolution to decipher that second tone. And that's pretty much how they're putting it in. And it's being put in at a fairly low level. Arbitron does provide a monitor that we have one in our master control room, and we have another one at the transmitter site that's hooked up to the remote control. So if the coding does stop, we get red lights, and in the case of the remote control, it yells, screams, hollers, picks up the phone, makes a phone call, does everything but send up flares to let us know that we, you know, we're not being raided right now. But with
hey, that sounds important. You just said to let you know that we're not being raided right now.
Right, and
it was a good 6 months before I heard of Arbitron, this PPM technology, before I realized, oh, this could be really important, because if you're not being rated, then you might as well have shut your transmitter off from a financial spot sales point of view.
Well, that's the case, because now it's become, you know, the Arbitron PPM is just as important as having the transmitter on the air. We did have an encoder fail one evening, and I've got an encoder on transmitter A and an encoder on transmitter B, so I've got separate encoders on the separate transmitters. They called me from the office. I had them put transmitter B on, and, you know, it's a quick 2-second flip, and coding came back, and life was good the next morning. I have a spare sitting on the shelf. I stopped at the transmitter site and popped the spare in and sent it back to Arbitron with no problems. But I can tell you at this low level, when PPM was first coming to New York, we had a Society of Broadcast Engineers meeting where Arbitron was the sponsor to talk about PPM. And we had put it on WOR for the meeting. We held it in the WOR conference room, and we had this little piece of trash little radio that was sitting on the windowsill, which had interference on it, which was operating at a very low level. And we were having a conversation in the room, just like we're having here. And near the end of the meeting, the gentleman from Arbitron pulled this little thing off his belt, plugged it into a device that he had hooked up to his laptop computer, and pulled out all the codes for the hour we were sitting there. So even walking around the room with all the noise, it still heard the coding. It was quite impressive.
That is amazing. Chris Tobin, you've got a bunch of stations there. You code Arbitron PPM on every one of those?
Every station, yes. We have PPM encoding on the primary carrier, the HD2 carrier, HD3, on all of the internet streams that we produce. Yeah, we've got a lot of encoding going on. We've got actually two racks full of encoders, decoders, monitors. I've got the decode monitors hooked up to boxes that will email when there's a issue. So I know exactly when my PPM encoding has been disrupted, whether it's the encoder failing or for some reason reception at our studios has been faltering, and I'll know exactly what to do. So basically no PPM encoding. Yes, you're right. We're not making money. We're not being rated. But I think I would agree with Skip. It's the PPM craze. I am not a fan of the way it's been rolled out. I'm not a fan of the methodology that's being used. I believe it's actually breaking the business model that we currently are familiar with. But I do agree with Skip that it's the tail wagging the dog. We need to rein in this crazy, change everything we do in order to match the algorithm that PPM now has. I'm watching our programming folks, and I've talked to people outside the company who are programmers, telling me how they've modified their program clocks so that we can optimize the PPM the way it works. Like, yeah, but what about the person you're trying to reach? Because at the end of the day, if you don't satisfy the audience, they're going to go elsewhere. And, you know, you've just screwed up everything. And PPM has made it worse rather than help. So, yeah, we're monitoring like there's no tomorrow, and we're keeping a track. And I've got several encoders in line ready to go. In the case one fails, we turn one on. We keep it going. But I just think the business model is being totally flipped upside down as a result of just.
Of course, even when the business model for Arbitron was written diaries, there were things radio stations did to try to influence the proper filling or maybe the improper filling out of those diaries. Like, if somebody asks you what station you're listening to, be sure you tell them it's KISS 102. Write it down.
That's correct. And yes, and the diary system did have its flaws, but the diary system is a memory retention or recall. It's a recall system. Yeah. PPM is real time. Real-time evaluation of something you're doing. You know, 20 years ago, radio was a destination for people on many levels. Maybe you'll call it lifestyle. Maybe you'll call it workplace. Today, it's just another place on the plate of many other sources. PPM gives you a real-time look at, wow, I'm an all-news radio station. People use me in the following manner, like a toaster in the morning only. My middays suffer because now they've gone somewhere else to get their news. I should be, as a radio station, saying, hey, let's promote the web element of what I do, get them to the computer to get back to where we are, so that the recall part of what we're about can still be used, and PPM can reinforce it. Yet when I talk to programmers at a couple of the RTNMDA for the news, I've been to RAB, I go to places for non-traditional engineering, and some of the folks, when I talk to them about, so what are you doing to keep ahead of the curve, it's like an upheaval. They're just flipping everything upside down, what they program. I'm like, wow. So, yeah, paper diaries did have their flaws. And, yes, tell a friend, write it down, you know, all those wonderful phrases. But at the end of the day, the audience wasn't aware that they were being manipulated as much as we are doing it now. Some of the music stations play songs in a certain way now that is more annoying than it was when they did the 40 minutes, free, you know, nonstop music.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is, when I first got into the business, we had a daytimer in the market, and in the winter when they were off the air at 4:30 in the afternoon in December, that station came in number one, 7 at midnight, because people were just writing down, they were listening to that station 24/7, and you know, in a way it's good. With PPM, you're probably not going to have that happen anymore, because if the station's off, you can't listen to it, but on the other hand, six, one half of a dozen of the other for which method could be more accurate, which one's better. I don't know. I just don't know. You know, with the PPM around the office, it's probably more a more accurate method, because you're not listening to, let's say, WOR on the web all the time. If you go to have a meeting with Harry in the office next door and he's got Light 106.7 on, because now when you're sitting there talking to him, you're listening to a different radio station. You're not listening to WOR straight through. So in certain instances, it probably could be more accurate.
Wasn't the Arbitron paper diary the reason why we have things like No Repeat Thursdays?
Yeah. Contest at 7:30 on a Thursday. That was the hot diary time.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry, I keep interrupting somebody. Is that Skip?
Just to sum up on this, I think one of the great advantages for technologists here is that you can literally, I mean, Chris said this, I just want to stress and make sure everybody got it clear. Every one of your multiple output streams now, you can measure independently. And it doesn't matter, you know, the listener may not even remember whether they're listening to the radio on, and certainly they wouldn't on a diary, have listened to your radio on a radio or on their internet or a PC or on a handheld device and so forth. So this is really nice to have that kind of granularity of information that you can see where your HD2 is, where so that's really important and helpful, and that's the good news. And meanwhile, as broadcast engineers, you can see why this is, as we've said, just as important as the transmitter in some respects. And so as the PPM continues its onslaught and deployment down, you know, further and further down market, engineers in those places are going to all have to be, aware of what's going on and how it works and keeping it running and so forth, as the guys that are in market one there or close have told us. They've been doing it pretty much as long as anybody, but there's a lot of folks who haven't, where it hasn't even gotten to yet. So it's going to be a continuing issue for a long time, and it's a learning curve that I think all radio engineers are going to want to get up to speed on, so that we can find out what happens. And then meanwhile, Arbitron is doing, I think, a pretty good job. They've got plenty of codes. They've got enough codes to be able to service a lot more channels as we get into more and more platforms, and can continue to keep independent analysis going on all of those. And that's really so important for broadcasters, because that's one of the biggest challenges broadcasters have right now, is to think about themselves as not just a radio, an over-the-air transmitter delivery service, but a content provider that has that legacy channel as well as many others, potentially. Many outputs. Used to be a lot of inputs to one output. Now it's a lot of inputs to a lot of outputs. It's a real matrix. So having that kind of data is really going to be helpful to decide how to, allocate resources and move forward into new spaces. And engineering is critical in keeping that all going. And hopefully Arbitron will settle out some of these statistical issues that they have too, in terms of just getting more of these devices in the field and satisfying folks that they're really getting valid statistical samples.
One of the issues, one of the things I want to ask you about, Skip, is new uses for RBDS or RDS, more correctly RBDS in the U.S. What are some new applications that you're looking at down the pike?
One of the most interesting ones is the smart grid applications. That is where thermostats in people's homes can be outfitted with a simple little FM receiver with RDS in it. And it can avail itself to some of these utility control systems. It's an opt-in kind of thing that the homeowner would get involved in if they wanted to. And there's everything from just telling you that the rates go down after 10 o'clock at night. So if you want to, you know, don't do the laundry till then, that's one thing. But also if there's brownouts, critical service outages, there's also switches that can be put onto things like hot water heaters and other devices that where you don't have to, where the utility company, when push comes to shove and they really are facing a rolling brownout or something, they can just shut off certain devices in people's homes instead of having to turn all the power down or off into various areas for load balancing. So it would give them a lot more ability to have finer grained load balancing opportunities. And it's a simple way to get the service signal there. Because obviously FM RDS is pretty mature technology. It's already ubiquitous practically. And a lot of the broadcast footprints for radio match the utility service footprints, by and large in many metro areas. So it actually plugs in real nicely into that space. So that's one of the most unique applications that we see coming for RDS.
I can see the potential to save power, but you won't be seeing these devices placed on people's transmitters.
You mean broadcast transmitters?
Yeah, broadcast transmitters.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Certainly saves some power like there now, couldn't it?
That's like the old the paging company that said, we'll give your engineers pagers so that they'll know when the transmitter's off the air if you put our subcarrier on your transmitter.
Yeah.
And that worked until, you know what happened. You can figure that one out. But the broadcaster doesn't have to do very much either on these services, which is nice. Very simple to enable. But they, get a little check every month from the power company. So a nice little bit of business maybe for radio stations going forward too. The tagging is the other one that we talked about a little bit, song tagging. And that one's got a nice revenue opportunity for broadcasters. And it's, I think, really been well received by users as well, as we see more and more of these radios that can that are enabled to take advantage of this tagging to be able to download a song. It can work pretty well. You can, with something like the Zune, where you have Wi-Fi as well as FM, a connected radio, if you will, you can tag a song while it's on the air, and it can be downloaded and onto the device before the song finishes playing on the radio. I mean, for real, I mean, that works. And that's a pretty cool idea, and the radio station can get a percentage of that sale at the end of the month. So it works. It works pretty well for everybody. I think it's an exciting new leveraging of that convergence that we've talked about before with the radio and the internet.
Skip, we just have a couple minutes left. I'll give Tom and Chris a chance to ask some follow-up questions here in just a minute. But first, Skip, tell us about what you're talking about at NAB. I believe you have an audio over IP seminar that you're giving along with the folks at SBE and the Ennis Foundation, and then you also have a book about audio over IP that you co-wrote with my boss, Steve Church of Telos.
Right, who is also the recipient of the owner of the NAB Technology Awards at the Engineering Awards at the Technology Luncheon at NAB too. Well-deserved. Mm-hmm. Steve and I put this book out in October of last year, and Focal says it's one of their top sellers so far in the broadcast space. So I'll be doing a 2-hour first thing in the morning, bright and early, tutorial at the SBE Ennis session from 8 to 10 a.m. on Saturday, the first weekend of the show. I'm also going to be doing a session later on something called the New Radio Model with a bunch of other consultants. I'm the sort of token techie on that panel, But we'll be talking about some of these new ways that radio stations can make make something out of their space in this new digital environment. And then a piece on a session on in the radio data session on the enhancements that we've been talking about, I guess, to speak generally about it, things that are already here, like the tagging, as well as radio DNS, the other things that are coming along that are ways that broadcasters can enhance their service through some extensions of their traditional media, and things that can work even with just with FM. It doesn't have to be necessarily HD radio, but of course that's part of it as well. So there's a lot of different areas. As we say, there's so many things going on. You got to go to a zone defense here. So that's where that's what we're looking at for this year's show. And as I say, I think it's going to be a pretty big and pretty busy show. Thanks for the book plug. We're going to be doing a book signing, Steve and I, at the NAB bookstore. In the main lobby of the show, I think that's on Tuesday around lunchtime. So we got our hands full, and then I do want to plug one other thing. We're doing a conference with Radio Inc. in June. So once everybody gets back and settled, and the dust settles off of their shoes from the desert out in Las Vegas, we're doing a session that we hope will also stimulate that dialogue between managers and engineers together, out at the Microsoft Silicon Valley campus in Mountain View, California. So it should be a fun couple of days of talking tech and talking business for the new new environment for radio broadcasting. That's called the Radio Tech Summit, June 2nd and 3rd, and followed by the Convergence 2010 program that Radio Inc. puts on. That'll be the manager's discussion on June 3rd and 4th.
Well, if people want to order the book, Audio over IP or IP Audio, that you co-wrote with Steve, there's places they can do that. One of those places is at the This Week in Radio Tech website. We've got an advertisement there from Amazon. You can click on that, buy this book, and yes, the folks at Twirt will get about $2.44 out of that to help defray our cost of running the website. There's other places to buy it too, like at the NAB store and from Focal Press and from Amazon. You don't have to click on our link. Skip, if people want to find out more about either the Ennis Workshop coming up at NAB or the project that you have coming up in June in California, where would they go?
The NAB site has a pretty good listing of all the broadcast engineering conference sessions, all the conference sessions in general. It's nab.org. And click on, I think they have it under education, and then you find the conference schedules. And radioinc.com has links, a banner up on the top that of the site when you get there that tells you about the conference info coming up in June.
Is that Inc. with a K or a C on the end?
It's a K, sorry. Radio Inc. Radio Inc. Or Radioink, as some of us say. Radioink.com.
Right.
And it's a nice site that has all the headlines of the daily business, as well as links to some of those other things, and including the conference, and the agendas are up there, the speakers, and registration information and the like. So go for it.
Tom Ray, closing comment or question?
Actually, I'd just like to ask Skip with the tagging, Skip. Is that a deal you make, the station makes, with someplace like Amazon or iTunes, or do you go to the record company, or how does that work? Just very, very briefly and very short answer.
Yeah, Jump to Go is the company that manages it as for radio stations to connect to the Apple iTunes and Zune Marketplace stores. Jump2go.com, J-U-M-P, number 2-G-O.com, Seattle-based company. Our old buddy Alan Hartle, one of the real great champions of RDS, is in this country, is the guy behind that. So check it out, and they can take you from there.
Excellent. Thanks.
Got you. Chris Tobin, you got a last comment or question?
No. Skip covered everything. I'm in good shape. Any more questions, we'd go beyond our allotted time.
Oh, we almost have. We just about have right now. Well, hey, thanks very much. Skip, you got anything last for us before we sign off?
No, thanks for having me again. Look forward to seeing you in person at NAB, hopefully, and on the pages of Tech Inc. and Radio Inc. starting next month.
All right. Thanks very much for joining us, Skip Pizzi. We appreciate you taking an hour of your time, and also Tom Ray and Chris Tobin. Thank you for being along with us, too. Hey, if you've heard this podcast, well, you can subscribe to it at the iTunes Store. Just do a search at the iTunes Store for TWIRT, T-W-I-R-T, or This Week in Radio Tech. Subscribe to it. It'll work in iTunes, either in Windows or on the Mac. You can also get the RSS feed. There's ways to do it there. You can also find us on Facebook and listen to the show or download it from a link that you'll find on Facebook. Just look for TWIRT on Facebook. I also update my Twitter feed when we do a new show with a link that you can go to and download. You can follow me on Twitter. It's K Harnack. That's K-H-A-R-N-A-C-K. And I promise not to bother with too much stuff on Twitter. If you follow my tweets, we'll try to keep it just to engineering stuff. Thanks a lot for being with us, and thanks to the folks at the TWIT Network for engineering tonight. I sure appreciate it. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another TWIRT has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes Store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.